Item one, and maybe it's just me, but it feels like there is a change coming. We will discuss. Item two, the vaccine economy. And item three, hey, you want that food delivered or what? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, this one is the 17th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am going to say this, then we're going to talk about it, and we're going to talk about all the other stuff that will contextualize this week for you. But here you go. My framing thought, if you will, for the next 6 minutes or so of live radio. This kind of feels, this week, maybe next week as well, like a tipping point. Like it either starts getting better or it starts getting a good deal less better. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
All right, Catherine, you get to start today. Test my premise. Does it feel like we're on the cusp of either better or not better?
It sort of always feels that way, given how much uncertainty there is right now about the path of the pandemic and the path of the economy. But I will say that, yeah, I mean, there are a number of sort of ticking time bombs about to explode. One of which, of course, is the impending expiration of the enhanced unemployment insurance benefits. Mm-hmm. And what that would mean if Congress does not come to some sort of agreement about what to do there. You know, that's going to be a lot of money taken out of the economy, potentially taken out of consumer spending. You have state and local governments still facing a major fiscal crunch. What kind of layoffs might be coming down the pike because of that? And of course, what's going to happen to the private sector if infections continue to surge, mm-hmm. and consumers are afraid to go outside? So there's a lot of uncertainty. I think there are a lot of red flags, but you know, some of these problems are solvable. Some of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hate to be the pessimist here, but it feels like to me we're on the tipping point between worse or much worse, right? So, if Congress doesn't approve that aid, we could be in for a very long and very painful period for the economy. And to me, it seems like it's pretty clear that we're still going to be struggling in November, no matter what. You know, we saw strong job gains in May and June, but now with new cases spiking so much, it seems like that economic recovery is not going to be rapid, to say the least.
Well, Catherine, I'm obliged to point out here that the latest Quinnipiac poll had the economy as the number one concern of people who were polled. The coronavirus was number two, about which two things. Number one, that obviously has political implications for November, as Anna was saying. Number two, they're the same thing, the virus and the economy.
Well, the virus is in control of the economy, essentially, at this point. But I think it's not surprising that people are so concerned about economic conditions, right? We are in our worst economic conditions in, what, 80 or 90 years? Mm-hmm. People are worried about being able to buy food, being able to pay their rent, their other bills. If they're laid off, are they going to be brought back to work? In what capacity? So, of course, this is what people are thinking about. And I think it's not surprising that that might affect the election, right? The economy has historically been the incumbent, President Trump's forte. It's the only issue on which he's relatively consistently polled with a net favorable outcome. And, you know, rightly or wrongly, people tend to give the president credit for current economic conditions. So, of course, polls like this are going to give some insight into the outcome of the election, the likely outcome of the election in November.
Anna, I need to go overseas with you here for a minute and to China. Attorney General Barr gave a very pointed speech about China and the global economy. The president has been saying less than kind things about the Chinese. They had that setback over Huawei. The Chinese did in the UK. That is still there. The trade war and this now very contentious bipolar relationship.
Oh, absolutely. It seems to be heating up. There's always been this tension in the Trump administration between China hawks who are really suspicious of China as a security threat and China doves who are more conscious that tensions with China threaten American businesses and the stock market. But it does really seem like the hawks are winning the day now. And I think that's due to a combo of things. It's partially in response to some more aggressive actions by China. For example, there was a new security security law that increased China's control over Hong Kong. But a lot of it is in the Trump administration, you know, the feeling that the terms of the trade deal aren't necessarily being met. And then also the Trump administration switching into campaign mode, where they really want to put the blame for coronavirus on China, and they really want to paint Biden as being weak on China and the president as being tough.
Catherine, let me get back to banks here for a second, or get back to the U.S. economy and banks. Earnings this week, they're, you know, making lots of money, of course, because they always do. But they're also setting aside a lot more money for bad loans. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, said, "We're going to feel the recessionary impacts, not right now, but down the road." That I'm going to take that as a validation of my framing thought for this entire conversation we're having.
Right. Again, there are a lot of these looming threats. It's not only the fact that the numbers look bad right now, but what are the knock-on effects of people not being able to pay their rent? If they can't pay their rent, the landlord can't pay his or her mortgage, and that affects the bank's bottom line. So there are all of these sort of knock-on effects that you can see policymakers anticipating. You can see the different links in that food chain anticipating as well. And if we don't know how quickly we're going to be able to recover, we don't know the magnitude of those domino effects later on. So you can understand why, even if things don't seem so terrible right now, if you're the CEO of a financial institution, you might be very, very worried about what happens a few months from now if infections don't get under control, if consumers don't start, you know, don't recover all of their spending, if businesses don't start hiring, and then you have, you know, this sort of, to use a bunch of different metaphors, you know, these shockwaves rippling out into other businesses.
Right. Anna Swanson, last word to you. You started our little chat here by saying you were pessimistic. Let me quantify that. How pessimistic are you?
I don't know exactly how to quantify it. And I think that's part of the problem, right? That there's just so much uncertainty right now. And I mean, as Catherine was saying, there's a lot of businesses, you know, concert venues, bars, movie theaters that are not going to be able to open safely for a long time. There are others that are going to have to operate at lower capacity and therefore lower profits. And so I think it's just a question of how many, you know, thousands of businesses are going to fail in the months ahead. And I hate to be so pessimistic on a Friday, but I hope you have something more uplifting later in the show.
So do I. We'll see when we get there. Anna Swanson at the New York Times, Catherine Pell at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kat.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, mixed for the day, up for the week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so one of the big indicators of that tipping point, Catherine talked about it right at the top of the wrap, is the looming housing crisis. Eviction moratoriums are coming to an end in a lot of places. A lot of government assistance for renters and homeowners is too. That could mean a wave of evictions and increases in homelessness in this economy. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has that one.
It's a crisis that's been brewing since the pandemic started. Record unemployment means nearly 20% of people missed their rent payments in June. Some state moratoriums on evictions mandated in response to the pandemic have already expired. Mary Cunningham with the Urban Institute says,
what we're expecting in July is a really steep cliff at the end of the month. And that's when two things happen that really have been preventing millions of Americans from losing their homes.
The extra $600 a week in federal unemployment benefits expires at the end of this month. And while the CARES Act prohibited evictions against people who lived in federally subsidized housing, that too expires next week. Experts are expecting a tsunami of evictions. Lisa Rice, president of the National Fair Housing Alliance, says the fallout will go beyond renters.
If people can't pay their rent, then landlords can't pay their mortgages and we'll have to lay off staff. And then that just exacerbates the unemployment rate.
And it will affect some more than others. Diane Yentel of the National Low Income Housing Coalition says,
people of color are most at risk of eviction. They are disproportionately rent burdened.
Some states and cities have either extended their eviction protection measures or passed renters assistance programs. But experts say unless sweeping action is taken, a countrywide storm is coming our way. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
The southern border of the United States is usually pretty fluid. People live and work on both sides. A lot of them go back and forth every day. Not, I think you can admit, the optimum conditions for containing a highly communicable disease. Marketplace's Andy Euler has been talking to some people at the Texas border to see what their economy is up against right now.
In the U.S., different rules from cities, counties, states, and the feds have made controlling the pandemic difficult. In border towns, there's also direction from two different countries. Federico Schaffler lives in Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, but drives across the border for work every day. He says at home right now, there's a curfew, and you can get fined if you don't wear a mask in your car.
On the U.S. side, I haven't heard beyond that. If you're by yourself in your car, well, you probably can have your mask down, but if you have two or three people, then you have to have your mask on.
Schaffler works on economic development at Texas A&M International in Laredo. He says cross-border shopping is a lifeblood for the area. But Laredo Mayor Pete Sines says people who want to cross just to buy stuff aren't allowed to do it right now.
A pedestrian bridge, it's reduced by 60-70%. Vehicular traffic, non-commercial, has also reduced by easily 30-40%, 50%.
He says yesterday, 8 people died of the coronavirus in Laredo hospitals, a record for the city. He says the state allowed businesses to open too soon.
What happened is we lowered our guard here and people started not using their masks.
Federico Schaffler says navigating this time isn't going to be easy for a lot of businesses.
I really don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's going to change a lot of things.
He says some businesses just won't make it. But if the area can get control of the outbreak, much of that commerce will come back quickly. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this is not a shopping competition.
But it would be nice to win.
Oh, it's a competition, all right. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 62 today, 0.2%, 26,671. The NASDAQ up 29 points, about 0.2%, ended at 10,403. S&P 500 grew 9 points, 0.2%, 32.24. For the week, the Dow up 2.3%, the NASDAQ down 1.1%, the S&P 500 up 1.2%. Jasmine talked about eviction moratoriums. Moratoria coming to an end? I don't know. So, a report out this week from the National Low Income Housing Coalition on how much a full-time worker has to earn to afford a rental home without spending more than 30% of their income. To be able to afford a two-bedroom home at fair market rent of just $1,246 a month, the report says workers need to earn more than $23 an hour. Here's the kicker. This report says that in no state, no city, or no county can a full-time minimum wage worker afford it by those measures. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The biomedical holy grail right now is, of course, a coronavirus vaccine. Nearly 24 are in various stages of clinical trials, and fingers are also, of course, crossed. But there is the small matter, this being the American healthcare system, of vaccine economics. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on that one.
Entos Pharmaceuticals is one of almost 200 groups worldwide trying to come up with a coronavirus vaccine. John Lewis is the CEO of the Canadian biotech company. He says he's not actually thinking about price right now.
I think what's on most people's mind is, you know, how can we achieve this?
Entos's technology uses DNA to trigger an immune response. It was originally developed to fight cancer, but the company pivoted and jumped in the ring to fight coronavirus. He says there is pressure to keep costs down, but the cost of a vaccine depends a lot on how it is made.
Does it need to be made in fermenters? Can it be, you know, filled and finished in a vial or a prefilled syringe? And are those manufacturing capacities available in the countries where you want to deploy the vaccine?
The cost of developing a vaccine, including basic research and clinical trials involving tens or hundreds of thousands of people, can be as little as $150 million. If the researchers are lucky and stumble quickly on something that works, it could go up to well past $1 billion, he says. That is just the cost. Out on the open market, vaccine pricing is opaque, a black box even, says Jason Schwartz, assistant professor of health policy at the Yale School of Public Health.
For decades, the vaccine divisions of drug companies were seen almost as charitable arms of their of those companies. Prices were low. There weren't a lot of profits to be had.
That changed in 2000 after a blockbuster pneumonia vaccine emerged on the scene and showed vaccines could make real money. Prices have risen ever since. Schwartz says in part because vaccine makers have a lot of pricing power.
The Affordable Care Act requires insurance companies to cover recommended vaccines with no cost sharing passed along to patients.
Insurers have to cover government recommended vaccines. And a federal program that pays for 50% of kids in the U.S. to get properly vaccinated is also required to purchase recommended vaccines. The price of a coronavirus vaccine is really anyone's guess. Bruce Y. Lee is professor of health policy at CUNY.
We can't rule out the possibility that these vaccines will be, you know, very high price. Developers are being asked to develop this very quickly, so they may demand a very high return on it.
Janssen and AstraZeneca, who've together received $1.7 billion in government support, both said their potential coronavirus vaccines would be offered on a not-for-profit basis during the pandemic period. The government awarded another vaccine maker, Novavax, $1.6 billion in exchange for ownership of the first 100 million doses of any coronavirus vaccine it makes. That comes out to an investment of $16 per dose, but the government-owned vaccines would then be offered to the public for free. And it may well be that several vaccines are developed at different prices. Bruce Wiley.
What if you have a vaccine that comes out that's not perfect, but it does reduce your risk of getting the disease by a certain amount? Well, that's going to have a different value from a vaccine that's higher efficacy.
And just to make it more complicated, internationally, vaccine pricing is all over the place, says Schwartz.
You see a spectrum of prices, a vaccine that may cost $150 or $200 a dose in the United States might cost $3 or $4 a dose in the 50 or 60 lowest income countries in the world.
The world's poorest countries get discounts through a combination of donations from wealthier countries and agreements with vaccine makers to lock in purchases for several years. There's a similar effort underway to cover coronavirus vaccines. Epidemiologists say if the virus is allowed to survive anywhere, it is a threat everywhere. Price, they say, shouldn't be a barrier to fighting it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
So what should be nobody's surprise, online grocery shopping is the new thing. Sales here hit a record $7 billion in June. One imagines that'll only keep on going up. And it turns out the same thing is happening all over the world with online groceries and food delivery. And the stakes are real high because A, everybody's got to eat, and B, the biggies are fighting it out. Amazon and Uber Eats are competing for global customers against the likes of China's Alibaba. So we asked Marketplace's Jennifer Pack in Shanghai and Scott Tong in Washington to do a little electronic shopping.
This is not a shopping competition.
But it would be nice to win. Scott and I are each going to use digital apps to order two meals, one for food delivery, one for groceries.
We started my house outside D.C. During the pandemic, my family has been shopping jointly with our neighbor Lauren Eskovitz and her family. We meet outside and combine shopping lists.
Chloe.
Here's her sixth grader, Margot.
Protein powder, frozen fruit without pineapple, fresh cod.
I'm going to make codfish tacos and see if our system can deliver fresh fish quickly. When the virus began, my neighbor Lauren says American delivery apps like Amazon Fresh and Instacart were overwhelmed.
It was really, really difficult to even find a slot to have groceries delivered. You'd put in all your stuff and there's like nothing for like 2 weeks.
Instacart's a lot faster now, even though grocery sales in the U.S. have grown sixfold during the pandemic. Fresh fish. I type in our joint order and voila, delivery scheduled in 2 hours.
Seafood sounds like a yummy idea, Scott. I'll do the same.
Game on, Jennifer.
I'll use a popular app by Chinese tech giant Alibaba called Hema. Today's special, $13 Boston lobsters, live. And I've just the friend to help me cook them. Let me ring her up on the social media app WeChat.
Wei.
Hi.
On the Hema app, we select two small lobsters. It even tells us the origin, Canada.
Wait, the app tells you where it was caught?
Yeah, it even gives recipe suggestions.
Well, as my kids would say, that's fire.
Yeah. We're going with the first recipe, lobster stir fry. Add ginger, spring onion, and Chinese broccoli to the cart, all for $28. Zero delivery fee, and the food can arrive in half an hour. Haha.
Haha. Well, in America, delivery is not 30 minutes, and it is not free. For a $140 tab, it's $18 for delivery and tip. And now I'm getting all these texts. My Instacart shopper, her name is Maria, keeps telling me about items unavailable.
Factory handmade tortillas out of stock.
Okay, Maria, I need to pick another.
Driscoll strawberries replaced with fresh strawberries.
Okay, Maria, approved. And now, great, the delivery is delayed. How do you solve a problem like Maria?
Alibaba's Hema app has pretty much solved it. It invests a lot in warehouses and logistics, according to William Baobin with the global venture capital firm SOSV in Shanghai.
Ordering groceries online is much more advanced in China than the U.S. And when I say advanced, it's market penetration. I'd say more than double the amount of groceries are ordered in China for delivery versus the U.S.
So as we wait for my groceries, let's move on to meal number two. Restaurant delivery. Some forecasters think U.S. food delivery sales will double this year.
Yeah, but in China, the top two meal delivery apps have more users than the entire population of the U.S. These apps even deliver hot pot, a meal you cook yourself, putting meat and veggies in a pot of boiling broth at the dinner table.
喂，你好。哦，喂，你好。哦，对，我这边到了。
The delivery guy brings a box full of raw lamb, fish cakes, and turnip. Plus, for an extra $4, I get a mini pot and fuel to cook with. That's like ordering barbecue and getting a mini grill to do it yourself.
Speaking of, we are now ordering barbecue from the restaurant Federalist Pig in D.C. It's delivered through the app Postmates. Ooh, there's brisket, there's pork belly.
Oh, these Brussels sprouts look so good.
That's my foodie daughter, Audrey. For a $64 meal, we shell out another $20 for delivery and tip, which is why we hardly ever order in.
Well, in China, delivery apps like Meituan offer so many discounts, ordering in can sometimes be cheaper than cooking. But the companies make their money through volume. Liu Guangrong delivers for food app Elema, which in Chinese means hungry yet?
During the peak lunch hour, the app can send me up to 15 orders in one delivery run.
15 at a time? U.S. efficiency is behind here. And this matters because American grocery and food apps are now competing against Chinese giants for customers in Latin America, in India. This is a global food fight. Again, venture capitalist William Baobin.
When you look at India, they're definitely going more towards the China model. Whereas the U.S., the big box format with large parking lots and everybody driving a car, you're simply not going to see that in Southeast Asia and South Asia.
Meanwhile, my groceries finally come. My neighbors take their share, and they wanted a small pack of chicken, but it wasn't available, so it got replaced. And
replaced
so,
with 8,000 drumsticks.
Do you like chicken drumsticks?
I mean, we are going to eat them.
Oh, my gosh.
And finally, we grill. And our Cajun fish tacos turn out fabulous, even though our groceries took 2.5 hours to arrive.
In that time, I've already cooked and eaten the ginger spring onion lobster noodles. Victorious in Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak.
And in Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Common Sense Division. The Centers for Disease Control says, yeah, no, you are not going on that cruise quite yet. It's officially called a no-sail order. It's in effect until the 30th of September. Remember, of course, we all started paying a whole lot of attention to the virus, in part when all those outbreaks started happening on the high seas. But look, I mean, would you go right now? All right, we're out of here. The Dow Industrial's down 62 today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 29 points. That's about 0.2% there as well. S&P 500, 9 points to the good, 0.2% there as well. Look at that. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend. Everybody get some fresh air, wear a mask, wash your hands, be safe. All that good stuff that I say on Friday afternoons. We'll see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.